Good afternoon and welcome to Burghage Hall. Thank you for joining us for event 62 of Ledbury Poetry Festival and coming to listen to the National Poetry Competition winners of 2016. Before we begin, I'd just like to first show our appreciation to Arts Council England and thank them sincerely again for their sponsorship and continued support of the festival as a whole. And now I'll hand it over to Judith Palmer from the National Poetry Society.
Thank you very much indeed. So I'm director of the Poetry Society, and it's always such a pleasure to come back to Ledbury. We have a long-standing tradition of working with the Ledbury Poetry Festival on showcasing the winners of our competitions. So last week we had the winners of our Young People's Competition, some previous winners from the Foyle Young Poets, and today we've got the winners of the National Poetry Competition. So the competition is now its 40th anniversary next year. Some of the biggest names, really, in British poetry have won this prize over the years. Tony Harrison, Joe Shapcott, Helen Dunmore, James Berry, and the poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy all won this competition at a very early stage in their careers, actually. And we've had winners at all stages of their careers. Sometimes we've had a well-known writer, sometimes somebody who has entered with the very first poem they've ever written have been among the winners. But I think we're most excited when the winners are just at that stage, you know, they're just publishing their first pamphlets, they're in anthologies, they're in magazines, and they're just ready to sort of launch on a bigger stage. And that was what this year's competition threw up. We had 10 fantastic winners this year, chosen for us by our wonderful judges, Maniza Alvey, Jack Underwood, and Jerry Cambridge, who have impeccable taste, clearly. So when you win the National Poetry Competition, there's a few things that happen. You're published in the Poetry Review, the Poetry Society's magazine. You're published in a small anthology. But probably the best of all is you get to read at Ledbury. So that is why you must enter the competition, because you could be here and we'd love to hear from you next year. So we've got three fantastic poets that we're going to listen to. And the first poet is T.L. Evans. Tom Lloyd Evans was born in Ilkley in Yorkshire and has come here today from his home in Berkhamsted in Hertfordshire. He's been writing poems mainly on his phone on the train to and from his office job in London over the last year or so. And his work to date addresses subjects such as how bad his commute is, hip-hop, carrots and tea. And he's come up in a couple of Poetry Society competitions. He was runner-up in our stanza competition last year with a poem called Coffee Ring. And then he was the third prize winner in this year's National Poetry Competition. You'll see when he reads that he often writes sonnets and rhymed poems. People always say, why does nobody do this anymore? And they do, and they can win competitions, as Tom is the proof. The winning poem that he wrote for this competition was called Detuned Radio, and the judges were particularly impressed by its pacing, its impeccable construction, and it was described by Jerry Cambridge, the judge, as an Uri poem that never quite reveals its full hand. So be prepared for Uriness and impeccable construction. Please welcome Tom Lloyd Evans.
Thank you very much indeed. Wow, this is a ridiculous honour to be here. So I'm Tom Lloyd Evans. I've got four things to read to you today. The first one is Detuned Radio, and it's a bit grim. So after that, I've got a sort of a palate cleanser of a couple of sonnets that are a bit more kind of whimsical. Then a darker one, which is Coffee Ring, which is a sonnet as well. Then I've got a few from a pamphlet that I'm trying to write called We're All Going. So any feedback would be appreciated afterwards, preferably, or you know, chuck stuff. And then I've got hopefully what is a thought-provoking poem and quite a sad one at the end, just to tee things up nicely for Caleb, who's on after me. So before I start, though, I'd like to say thanks so much to the Poetry Society, particularly to Judith and Ollie Fox, who It must have been champion cat herders in a previous life, because we're not the easiest bunch to organise poets, but you do a remarkably good job. And also Paul McGrain, who runs the Stanza Club. Thanks too to Margaret and everybody who has organised this amazing festival in this fantastic town. Detuned Radio. My mother said she'd never heard such rage within a child, she told me later, after the doctor and after the pastor. I don't recall the nights within the cage. I'd raise my 2-foot frame against the bars and fill the little room, my mother said, with screaming, screaming that could wake the dead, my fists and eyes clamped shut against the dark. I don't remember much till I was saved. It was by chance her detuned radio, whose crackling plugged the quiet's monstrous hole. I sank beneath its filtered, whispered waves. Still now, when silence starts to sink its gap, I hear the desperate presence climbing up and twitch the dial to static's frequency. Its hiss alone can make the thing retreat. We used to top and tail, me and my twin. And when the white noise stops, she speaks again. So that's a party starter, isn't it? Now for a couple of sort of palate cleanser ones. So I write poems on my phone. My commute is about a sonnet writing length in time. And so, unsurprisingly, the first one is about my commute. Now, this is to be taken with a bit of tongue-in-cheek. It started off being called London Midland is the winner, and then I changed it to Southern Rail is the winner. But it could be basically insert your train operating company name here is the winner. And I'm going to ham it up a bit, so excuse me. Beneath hell's third and darkest circle curl twin parallel, grotesquely tightening lines, two spirals infinite of iron spines around which Lucifer's express trains whirl. In screeching metal cages here they drive, nightmarish creatures of such vile dread, Hieronymus himself would wet the bed, and Sauron would avert his burning eye. The ticket inspectors, giggling with glee, torture the wretched, ticketless masses. All toilets out of order, first classes declassified for all eternity. And on the boardroom shelf, a tarnished cup, the worst rail franchise ever, runner-up. See what I did there? Zombies. They were in the office yesterday. At first, I thought they were the auditors. They somehow blagged it past security in what, with hindsight, were ill-fitting suits, suppressing groans and hiding bloodshot eyes. I showed them to the client room and asked my coffee, tea, and took their nil reply as rudeness, not the hunger of the dead. They dragged in Karen from accounts. She begged for time to normalise the P&L, but silenced by a rake of rotting claws, she flicked her laptop open, forced them back. Are you okay? I asked. She wiped a scratch. If you offered me a job like theirs, she said, I'd bite your arm off. Coffee ring. This is in memory of my grandmother, Barbara. I saw it on her desk, a blurry swirl of darker brown, exactly where I went to place my mug, a forearm from the edge, beside the letters labeled to be burnt. What seemed a perfect circle silhouette was actually the endless sum combined of smaller, partial coffee rings offset and fading logarithmically with time. Why keep the same old cup for all those years, its matching saucer long since chipped and cracked? Or why at least not use a coaster, make a sacrifice of just one paperback? I ask the silence. Silence never hears. I head back downstairs, rejoin the wake. So now I've got some about a summer holiday. so I'm trying to write a pamphlet, and it's called We're All Going. So here are a few from this. The first one's called On a Summer Holiday. So we're all going on a summer holiday. The lanes are narrow, rock and earth. Cholesteroled capillaries for the bloody cars and bloody caravans that lurch between the low gears in reverse. Outside, the haze is stifling under overhangs of seaweed green. Our windows dare to open just an inch to stop the stinging nettles whipping in. The humid mizzle mingles with my sweat. I press a midge into a Rorschach test. Our grim procession shuffles on, contracting and expanding and contracting. We're neither waves nor particles, neither here nor there. A seagull drops a giant turd of white, with pepper flecks of grey and black. The automatic wipers think it's rain and smear it across the glass and back again, across again, before I find the switch and turn it off. And there, in brazen stripes across my universe, I see this shitty story arc. A rainbow shot in monochrome. A ray of light from nowhere strikes its end, and as I'm easing off the clutch, it moves along the curve, revealing hidden colours. Titanium white erupts in ultraviolet. Lead grey incandescents to rose tint. God's own Instagram filter. To follow a dream. Back to sonnets, I'm afraid. The model lifeboat, the one in the shallows by the rope-shod harbour walls, degrading there at sea snail pace. Now it's dawn. The mackerel sky is mirrored on the channel, word for word. The flare that scalpeled through the night and effervesced unnoticed through the storm is boiled and sunk. The high-vis orange plastic is at rest. The embers of the flare are smoked and drunk. A minute's stride across the slabs, the Trent class in whose image it was made is open to the public once a week. A plaque trots out the souls it saved. A seagull perches on the prow, its beak methodically dismembering a child's crab. To go sand eeling. The mines have long since been abandoned, but Cornish tin has ways and means. The earth still casts its metal dreams in molten bubbles upwards through the sand each summer night. They burst and writhe in flashing grey like clouds condensed to knives. And at their tips, 1,000 pairs of quartzose eyes dug up, all witness live, the snare of line-caught bass for millionaires. Lifted from its sandbank bed, an eel is thrashing like it understands its fate. And though it has no wit to think or feel, the would-be baiter hesitates to cut its Cornish thread with Chinese steel. This next one's called To Be Saved, which my voice needs, sorry. To Be Saved. I was woken by the brush of her hem as I sat outside the working men's. Her runny nose and melted 99 mingled on her upper lip. Her squint met mine and gave a silent blessing. May you ever have sand in your shoes. May you ever have shells in your pockets. I made to speak, but a held hand pulled her on. And now you might be wondering why I brought this prop up here. this next one's called To Drink Cider and Be Merry. And it's a song. It's a song in the sort of the Paul Muldoon sense, i.e. it's not supposed to be sung. Probably wouldn't work if it was. And it's After Two Trees by Don Patterson, who's the inspiration behind Detuned Radio. Not personally, but his poem, The Lie, was. It's also, with apologies to my friend Will Green, who very politely pointed out that I nicked one of the images in this poem from him, or intertextualized, I think is the word, isn't it? So listen now, if you can pick the image that I stole from Will, then you win. You can come up to me afterwards and you'll win this bottle of Will Green plagiarism cider. another thing to mention in this is that it uses the word cheese, which doesn't mean the dairy product cheese. It's actually a container that you use to put apples in when you're making cider, made out of straw. So, to drink cider and be merry. The barley leaves and apple blossom stretched towards the sun, in different fields for different yields, and yet they stretched as one. The barley saw the blossom fall and swooned in disbelief. The orchard scoffed and raised aloft, the green buds underneath. The juvenile apples saw the husky grain go stiffer, and never cried when it was scythed, for they were hard and bitter. But as the apples ripened, and no autumn crop was sown, the winds blew stronger, and they no longer wished to be alone. And looking out across the stubbled barley, earth, and rock, the apple trees felt empathy, and fruit began to drop. Then to the falling apple flesh the orchard ushered in menageries of wasps and bees to drink its saccharin. The straw, meanwhile, was thatched to make an interwoven cave, a hollowed thing resembling a bathtub or a grave. The apples, picked or plucked or caught, were taken to confess. The sun beat down on bracken brown of cider cheese and press. The straw-wrought cheese took all the fruits the barrow boy could give and didn't warm its bristled form, for barley can't forgive. And as the apples took the strain, they thought their final thought. This crushing sieve and filtered pith was what they'd always sought. Thus, star-crossed straw and apple fruit succumbed mid-intercourse. Their juices went to slow ferment, the pomace to the horse. The scrumpy cider turns to piss against the apple trees, and horse manure does grace the floor of field of barley seed. Hence, in each cup, through all the years, the drinker will discern a sweetness and a bitterness, for apples never learn. A sweetness and a bitterness, for apples never learn. We're all going home, also known as a wibbing for my wife, Joanne. We lie in bed in parallel. I'm naked. She's on chapter two. Around us, I have placed on plinths the trophies of our first weekend back home. By our feet, a gilded iron cast depicting rubbish vanquished into tip. By the drawers, the emerald Nemean hide of mowed and edge-strimmed lawn. By her side, upon the dais, the candles paint the parchment scroll and waxwork seal of finished tax return in twilight's bronze and rose. I roll onto my side and draw my breath so as to woo her with my take on Shakespeare's sonnet 29. She pops a grape in my mouth at when, and with the glimmer of beginnings of a semi-smile, folds down the corner of her page. And now, the last one. This is a poem called The Flag, and it's also in memory. The phrase here, on call, by the way, means born in the bag, born in the amniotic sac, which is a sign of good fortune. The Flag. I was born a bath towel, one of a twin pack from IKEA. They bought us with a smile and a wedding voucher. We were delivered on call, and as my mother eased us from our plastic wrap, I saw in her face a universe of promises. We always did have many uses. My father knelt on me as he built the flat-packed shelves, the double bed, the chest of drawers with changing mat. He stopped to rest his back and swig his tea and saw the sun had swung around to light my sister, a golden fleece drying on the radiator. They'd roll us up and take us to the Lido. They always washed the chlorine off, but two of them were working all the time, and one fine day I made it as a beach towel. They never quite got rid of all the sand. We witnessed all their intimacies, of course, in carrying out our primary task. Her labour was precipitous, and from the 14th floor we wouldn't make it. So I opened out across the sofa, and as my father told her to visualise her safest place, my mother smiled through all the pain and gripped his hand to white and fixed him with her eyes and said that it is here, right here, and not to worry. The baby came soon after, straight from heaven, and she was wrapped up in my sister. In the years that followed, we were sailcloths, islands, togas, picnic blankets, curtain doorways into dens, pretend ice cream, a court short prayer mat on occasion too. We were woken by the stinging smell. It wasn't close to dawn, and yet an orange glow was climbing. Neighbours yelled. My father went to help, but at the door the smoke fell in, so he closed it gently so as not to wake the children. He came into the bathroom and addressed us. My sister, rolled and doused, was sent to lie against the frame, and he chose me to be our flag. He took me to the window, and together We rocked back and forth and back and forth and back and felt the lick of searchlights. Nothing more, but I was proud of us. And then all I thought was, what a shame to be. And in an instant, I am up and out, ashes fluttering into that familiar view like moth light, moth grey doves. I intermingled with my brothers and my sisters from the other stories, and as we fell and turned and whispered our thanks to those who'd kept us, they came to meet us, or the threads of their dreams. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, T.L. Evans. So our next poet is Caleb Parkin. Now, one of the other things we do with the National Poetry Competition is most years we also make film poems of the winning poems, and we're just about to release those. But I've had a sneak preview of Caleb's. I haven't seen the others. And you may have heard the poem that was based on Poetry Please a couple of weeks ago. And that was Caleb's winning poem in the National Poetry Competition. He's a poet, a performer, and a school workshop facilitator, except he has a better name for it, which is a writing explorer. So he is a writing explorer and a filmmaker himself. He's based in Bristol. He's previously worked in TV, radio and print media, and he's studying for an MSc in creative writing for therapeutic purposes. His works appeared online and in print journals, in planetaria, schools, museums, computer shops and wildlife events. He has had a pamphlet that was just shortlisted in the Rialto pamphlet competition. And his winning poem in the National Poetry Competition is called The Desktop Metaphor, which is an amazingly interesting poem on the page as well, as you'll see if you pick up a copy of the anthology. And when I first saw the poem in print, I was really interested to see how you lift that poem off the page into the air as well, as you'll hear. So our judges said of it, it's weird and smart and confident, bringing something vast, strange and unresolvable within reach. So here it is, within reach, Caleb Parkin.
Hello. I might just change my Twitter profile to weird, smart, confident. That's a good thing to go with today. So it's lovely to be here, entirely splendid to be in lovely Ledbury. And thank you for coming in from the lovely day out there and being with us. And thank you for your poems, Tom, as well, which are great. So I'm going to read you some poems from Gentle Voices of Machines, which is my pamphlet, the one that was shortlisted. I'm hoping someone will publish it at some point soon. So they all engage in some way with technology and voice and song and the interaction of those two. Hopefully quite playfully. And I'm going to start with The Desktop Metaphor, the title of which comes from the thing we use every day on our computers. It's not real. It's just code that is dressed up like a space. And I found this interesting. It seemed the right title for this. It references exoplanets, which are planets beyond our own solar system. I'm very interested in space. So that's what that reference is in here. The Desktop Metaphor. I meant to say, we're in a church, and they said this was quite churchy as well, so I'm going to try not to get carried away, but I might, so, okay. The desktop metaphor. There are holes in the sky, and we name them. We name them after things that matter. After things that matter, and the gods of our days. And the gods of our days like the great stapler. The great stapler, which attaches the night to us, which attaches the night to us and the words to ideas and the ideas to words, which are just light packaged in dark matter. Dark matter sent first class to our eyes, first class to our eyes so we might know their names. These things that matter. Things that matter like the photocopier. The photocopier scanning and remembering us. Scanning and remembering us as though we were exoplanets. We were exoplanets with atmospheres of ink. Ink, full of bright mating cries. Mating cries from gods of our days like the gull. The gull whose beak marks the poles. The poles whose screams are tectonic. Tectonic in the bin man's crackling eyes. Eyes where names do not matter. Not matter. So we name them. Name them. Holes in the sky. So that's that. Didn't go the full preacher on it, but maybe I will next time. I went for an eye test a while ago, as many of us do. I'm wearing contact lenses at the moment. They're magic. And I was struck by the experience and how kind of shaman-like it is and how intimate and peculiar and being surrounded by all this machinery. And when you see the back of your eye, you know that thing? You've seen that? And it looks like a planet and it's amazing. And I wrote this. The title comes from a meteorological phenomenon in Venezuela called Catatumbo lightning. And on the Catatumbo River, which flows into Lake Maracaibo, at 260 nights of the year, about 10 hours of the day, up to 280 times an hour, there is lightning. And look for photos of it. I've not been. I'd love to go, sort of. But look it up. So the title came from that. Catatumbo lightning. She places the colour yellow beneath my eyelids. The small room tints. My head positioned on a shelf. A cleansing fluid applied to this, herself, hinging her apparatus of light. I do as I am bidden, look up, look down, look to each of her ears. And the day is made in moments, a bright flash moving left to right, the sun's path set perpendicular. For an instant, it is there, in the capillaries, jagged deltas, branches, flares, rising from the sea, these clouds within me. Quick sip of water. I haven't guessed the quote, though, so I can't win the competition. Short poem with a long title. I was living in Huddersfield a few years ago and I kind of overheard this incident and stole it and turned it into a poem. So it's from a few years ago when something was going on. But at 15:30 BST, two school mothers conclude their retrieval and investigations in foggy conditions. That plane, one laughs. It's hiding. The other, hide and seek. Okay, so I really love form, and I'm really interested in form and experimenting with it. Catatumbo lightning looks like this, because sometimes the poems spread themselves out. But I love villanelles, and so I'm going to give you a couple of villanelles now. And in terms of song, they're one of the best forms, I think, for creating song. My sister phoned me on the way back from her holiday, and she was one place, I was another. And I wrote this villanelle based on a story she told me of an experience on holiday. A call. Melissa, in the flow of motorway, returning from a cottage by a stream. A voice washed down the line. What did it say? I cross a bridge, translucent branches sway. She'll tell me what she heard, as in a dream, Melissa, in the flow of motorway. One night she lies awake in hours dark grey. That sound, it was not murmur nor a scream, a voice washed down the line. What did it say? The droning of a man, a soft decaying stone left in that water. Heard, it seems, Melissa, in the flow of motorway. The neighbour, it was said, had moved away. Away from that aching nocturnal gleam, a voice washed down the line. What did it say? A bee sings overhead, driving the day towards some twisting leaf, far off downstream. Melissa, in the flow of motorway, a voice washed down the line. What does it say? It's kind of creepy. Yeah. An entirely different villanelle, right? This one's a bit of a performance challenge I've set myself. It's a found villanelle harvested from spam comments on my blog, on my website. So I thought I'd have some fun with. I'm going to give it three different voices today to bring out the form so it doesn't just merge into this weird computer voice, which it is a bit. One is a kind of Silicon Valley, New York, hello, that kind of voice. So I'm going to do that one. I'm going to, with extreme love and respect and admiration, channel Ivor Cutler for the other one because I've really enjoyed doing Ivor Cutler's voice. If you presumably people know of Ivor Cutler, he's amazing. I love doing his voice. So I'm going to do that. He's one of the people spamming my blog now. And my native Essex also because I'm from near Colchester and I'm going to turn on the Essex for the other voice. Six new comments. Hello. I read a lot of interesting content here. Probably you spend a lot of time writing. Do you know any plugin for SEO? If you know any, please share. I do believe that you ought to write more on this subject. It might not be a taboo subject. I read a lot of interesting content here. I am genuinely grateful to who shared this enormous article at here. Google-friendly articles in seconds. Just search in Google, low. If you know any, please share. But I'm not seeing very good results. Cheers! Usually people don't speak about such issues like plugin for SEO. Interest in content here. It's fastidious piece of writing. We understand media is enormous source following you. I like what I see, so following you. If you please, no, please any, share. What's up? Such clever work exposure. I enjoy what you guys are usually up to. I know how to save you. Interesting content here. Online tool to plug in. If you please, no, please. Hello. Colour-coded. I challenge that one. My partner Paul went to a stag do. Neither of us, I don't know, as a male couple, we don't really get invited on them. I don't know, I was losing that. And he went to a drag race, not the kind we usually watch on television. RuPaul, it's great. So I was experimenting with prose poetry, and it occurred to me to write a bit about this and perhaps engaging with masculinity and things. Stag. I'm imagining you as Louis Theroux through a screen of fumes from obscene muscle vehicles, or should the sky chop it all off with drizzle in a tent among a pack of deflated men, wasted, bored. And perhaps you'll talk about the obsession with VWs, the luster of their colours, how their roofs open up, expanding like an idea. The intricacies of the folding interiors of every man. Perhaps you'll talk about the ways that rust and decay can set in, how these thin tin cans on wheels can be a home away from home. Dirty curtains, little shelves to store dusty Mad Max dreams on, a home to be freed from home or ourselves. Another little song, as you'll hopefully know, Rosetta, the space probe, went up and followed a comet. Isn't it amazing we can do things like that? Space often comes into my writing, and so I thought I would give a little song for their interaction. It's a nice little rhyming song, which I enjoyed writing. Oh, and just to say as well, the planetarium project I did last year, I got to work in a planetarium and make 360 degree video poems, which is the most splendid thing to be able to do. I had like washing machines going around and things like this. So I want to do more of that because planetariums, great spaces. Rosetta hears the comet sing. I sing the blue craters sunk in your face. I sing my loss of solitude in staccato space. I sing the songs unsung by swatted bugs. I sing 3 million clicks on others' mugs. I sing the black shrapnel of this shrapnel sun. I sign on the dust line. I sing for no one. Okay. And finally, this is a piece that got commended in the Ware Open Poets Competition last year by Philip Gross. And I was really pleased that he selected it because it kind of came from a prompt he'd given of kind of what if, what then? And it's such a helpful idea, and I think you can get so far with it. I went to see a thereminist in Bristol called Lydia Kavina. A theremin is an instrument you don't touch, you play with its electromagnetic field. So you have one hand here, there's a kind of protrusion here, and then another hand doing this. And it's amazing to watch. Go and see a thereminist. It's great. And I thought, okay, well, what if, what then, with my theremin experience? And I wrote this one, which is called The Thereminist Hails a Bus. With a pinch of her right hand, the bus driver issues an electromagnetic tremolando. He doesn't know quite why the vehicle stopped, but the sliding door squeezed itself open, and much like Ferdinand on an island with six tires and two floors, he isn't quite in control. She hovers, her left hand flying saucer restlessly, and the mechanisms within the cylinders sing an air he is sure they never had before. Even now, on the transcript, as he recalls it, though his synapses have been known to be off key, he swears he didn't even touch the gear stick, made no contact with the steering wheel. But all he knows is that now, somewhere on this road that doesn't have a number, letters or lines, any tarmac at all, he feels sounds and sweet airs interrupting the music of birds of paradise in spacesuits, the gentle voices of machines. Thank you. I'll just trail a couple of things. My website is couldbethemoon.co.uk, which has loads of stuff on it. 27th of July, I'm comparing an event at Bristol Science Centre about what if we lived on Mars. Going to generate some crowdsourced Martian poetry. And 2nd of August, I'm running a workshop on skeletons at M-Shed in Bristol. So go on my website if you want to know any more about those. And also Green Man, we're going to be writing some poetic protest signs, which should be fun. Get involved in activism in a, you know, eloquent way, hopefully. So thank you very much for having me today. Cheers.
Thank you very much, Caleb Parkin. Another fantastic reading. Thank you. So the National Poetry Competition is judged anonymously. So all the poems come in, they're completely anonymous. I think it's the first time we've ever had the top three winners all be male. It was one of the delights of things that just happen. So I think we've had all women before, but not all men. And some of the things that also happen is sometimes we find things come up, like we have a tradition of Northern Irish winners of this competition. We've had Maeve Magouchian, Sinead Morrissey, Colette Bryce, and now we have another Northern Irish writer to add to that roster in Stephen Sexton. Stephen lives in Belfast, where he's studying at the Seamus Heaney Centre for Poetry, except he's just handed in his PhD, in fact, so he's no longer studying, I suppose. His poems have appeared in Granta, Poetry Ireland, Poetry London, and the anthology Best British Poetry 2015. Also, there's a fantastic new anthology of young Northern Irish writers called The Future Always Makes Me So Thirsty, published by Blackstaff. He's in that. The Ledbury Bookshop has copies of his wonderful pamphlet, Oils, which was published by the Emma Press in 2014, and which was the Poetry Book Society's winter pamphlet choice. He's recently been making a radio documentary going round the 32 counties of Ireland in 5 days with Bill Drummond. And he is now here. His winning poem in the National Poetry Competition was called The Curfew. And the judges described it as a tour de force, dreamlike in its shifts, wide-ranging and deeply felt. The language is alive and impressively adventurous. So another adventure coming up. Please welcome Stephen Sexton.
Hello, everyone. It's really lovely to be here. And I'm very grateful to the Poetry Society and to Ledbury for having me. If anyone ever says, why don't we drive around Ireland in a van in 5 days, say no. That's my advice. This poem that you'll hear about, I think it's going to be on Radio 4 in August or something, so you'll, depending on how judicious the editing is, you'll hear how comfortable or not comfortable it was. I'm going to start with a poem that has something to do with Ireland, but I decided not to work that out, but it's, you know, it's in there somewhere. And I guess, as you know, we're in the so-called decade of centenaries at the minute. This is partly thinking about that. Anniversary. The giddy cathedral swooned. The night had been unremarkable for being remarkable, and was much like 1916, and mostly unlike the Titanic. It would have been her 25th birthday, he said, of the older sister he always felt had been his shadow, who appeared in dreams as a porch light in the mist, an igloo once. Once as the breastplate and harness of Dolph Lundgren as He-Man. The bars were closing. Young men sallied in the streets like riderless horses. She never had a name, he said, so he thought of one. The avenue he lived on then reeled around a gigantic horse chestnut tree, and the pavement was lousy with conkers and seed cases. He said, you know, everything in the world either is or isn't that tree. Standing at the wrought iron railings, we recognized a man we'd never seen before. His distressed leather doctor's bag was handsome, and he opened it. One thing that I have more of, maybe even than you know, no, except for regrets. But I buy a lot of jackets. You know, I walk like many of you do. I'm sure find yourself in charming shops somewhere. And you know, I have far too many of them. But one day when I did buy one, I found a shopping list inside it. And you know, I guess I think about charity shops and secondhand clothes shops. And part of that experience, I guess, is in some way inhabiting the person who owned it before, or that's a way of experiencing it. And I was, you know, deeply troubled by finding a shopping list that didn't seem to be completed. So I thought about that. Daydream of the jacket. My new vintage houndstooth jacket was catching eyes in the aisles of the supermarket. I felt like someone else. An older man, perhaps, a taller man, a man without a beard. And when I saw myself reflected in the freezer glass, I was. I felt I had known myself for many years up to this point. I stood like the koi and decoy in the quiet supermarket between the frozen raspberries and the shredded suet when my neighbour, Mrs. Carmichael, rounded the corner. Coconut oil, coconut milk, desiccated coconut. Her basket was a who's who of coconut. I supposed she was cooking something with coconut, though Mr. Carmichael had always been the one to shop. Together at the checkout, she too admired my jacket and its unimpeachable stitches. This was when I remembered there had been rain on our wedding day, burgundy leather in the big car, a rear window, my parents. But into my jacket I slipped this morning a shopping list that for all my life I was sure I was someone younger. Then she said, you are my husband, aren't you? I am, I said, and went home. And since we kept canaries, fed the canaries. Among my other hobbies, you know, I spend a lot of my... Well, actually, I shouldn't do it now. It was okay when I was a student, but now that I'm unemployed, I shouldn't be playing pool all the time, but I like playing pool a lot. And I especially like an American pool player whose name is Earl Strickland. And the reason why I like him is because he's very, very good, but he's a horrendous person. He's a terrible loser. He's a terrible sports person, I guess. You know, he sort of thinks that he's really angry that you haven't heard of him, but I suspect many of you haven't. He feels that he is basically Tiger Woods. He feels he should be thought of as Tiger Woods. But he's kind of fascinating. He's one of those people who's kind of magnetic in some way or another. So I wrote an ode to him, except this is the opposite of an ode, I guess. Oh, Earl Strickland, I dislike you quite a lot. And it's not because you're a Gemini. You skulk up to the table like a Gemini, like a little god of diligence, fury, and full-body English nine-ball breaks. But it's not really even that. It's not the wraparound sports sunglasses or the pernickety quiver of break and game cues. And hey, a belly is not unbecoming for certain gentlemen of a certain age. It's not the bristled trapezium of your unmodish blonde moustache. It's not the cyan lycra billiard glove, she in the extreme, and less still, that weighted armband fixed around your bicep as an amulet or periapt. Whatever. Earl, yours is a game for one played by two, one of whom is you, and the other you. From those regional pool halls, eye-watering with smoke, a bad moon often on the rise, to the Riviera Hotel and Casino, Nevada, and the 8-Ball Open sponsored by Camel, you play in a long offbeat. A gold tooth rattles down a drainpipe. Earl Strickland, I dislike you quite a lot, and not because you shell-act Stephen Hendry. It's not the cues of Cocobolo or Rosewood, or who knows, the drawn, undressed neck and spine of a whooper swan, wrapped with stacked leather or Irish linen, or the cotton you picked for pool money on the farm in Roseboro, North Carolina, or its tobacco, or its fat-striped watermelons rolling in the back of a pickup truck at angles you could, as a child, calculate. Earl Strickland, I dislike you quite a lot for the junk of your regalia and your sneer. Earl Strickland, I dislike you quite a lot for the beauty you achieve when beauty is never your intention. Earl Strickland, make like Pangaea and break. Make like some ancient stage magician who has cinched the trick so many times he has finally forgotten how and when the sleight of hand happens, for whom it is a mystery the moment a white handkerchief turns into a dove. I think I'll read one more poem maybe about my hobbies. They're not really my hobbies. I just get obsessed with things very briefly for a couple of weeks and then it's gone again. But when I was very young, there was a fantastic place that opened in Belfast that was, you know, golden. It was one of those centres where young people could do everything. There was ice skating and bowling and mischief, I guess. But now it's really horrible. It's really run down. And I like to go there because despite its horrible character, there's something I remember about it. But one of the last times I was there, I got really into bowling for a while for some reason, and I wondered what it would be like to work in a bowling alley. And I guess I find bowling amazingly American, and I'm always kind of interested in, you know, that American cultural stuff that hangs around. Anyway, this is about that, and I guess I suppose that if I was working there, I'd be thinking about mysteries and thought experiments or something rather than doing my job. My second favourite locked room mystery. Since I started working in the bowling alley, I think about it all the time. In his barn, from a high rafter or crossbeam, a man has hanged himself with no ladder or platform to get him there. Nothing suspicious, save a patch of damp on the straw-strewn dirt floor. Cheryl, on the other hand, is really into tarot. When the soda fountain's not so busy, she shuffles up my destiny, and every time she seems to draw the lovers. Think about it, she winks, and flashes the braces in her smile, and the pin setters chew like beautiful mouths. Thinking about the future always makes me so thirsty, so while Cheryl sorts out pin jams and inventories the shoes, I slurp a Coke with plenty of chipped ice, And before long, my head is full of icemen and their cold chariots, horse-drawn ice ploughs, the lakes of Massachusetts. When she's fed up with kismet, Cheryl lets me build little card castles, and I sometimes think I could marry her some hot day in the summer, an ice sculpture of a bowling pin undoing itself into a puddle of water at the highest of June. And I think of his horses. What were their names? I'll read two more poems, if I may. One of them I would like to read is the one that was so kindly and generously chosen by the judges of the competition, and to whom I'll be almost eternally grateful, I'm sure. I would be eternally, were that possible, I think. But I'm very grateful. Anyway, this poem, I guess, I don't remember what I was thinking about when I was writing it, but nevertheless, it starts with lots of animals escaping a zoo. The curfew. The radicals sprung the locks that night, hurrah, and their lovely collarbones were almost moonly. Rhinos shrieked and bellowed, elephants tromboned, and the animals nosed into town. Sunrise to sunrise, and sunrise we kept indoors. If you can't count your onions, what can you count? My grandfather used to say. He said a lot of things. Among the other miners, he was legendary, when no more than the thought of the pink crumple of his infant daughter's body came to mind. A glow would swell in the pit. The men would mayhem bauxite by the light his tenderness emitted. Some of me lived inside her even then. The memorial fountain says nothing of the weeks before the rescue failed, but mentions God, which, as my grandfather used to say, is just the name of the plateau you view the consequences of your living from, or something like that. He said a lot of things. He grew wise and weary as an albatross and left for that great kingdom of nevertheless. It would have pleased his handsome shoulders to watch this grizzly scoop for salmon in the fountain of his friends, or the Bengals, or the Shikdan squad of chimpanzees who bang and bang on the grocery window. One by one, 11 miners starved to death. In the streets, they collar or tranquilize the ocelots and run a spike of ketamine through the plumbing in the fountain. Dromedaries blue mood around the pub, aloof under their reservoirs of fat. I don't sleep, but oh plateau, these days of violence have been my happiest. Even a cabbage is not without desire, my grandfather said one day. And now, among the animals, I feel under my wings the words for things I thought I knew departing, and I understand him. I'll read one more, if I may. On Saturday, I'm going to go on my summer holiday. The last time I went on a summer holiday, I went to Italy and did, as I guess, I suppose I'm going to do in Paris, is go and look at the famous graves of dead people. Well, geez, I hope they're dead. But one of the places me and my girlfriend found ourselves was in Rome, in the Protestant cemetery there, where many of the famous people are. And it was a day a little hotter than this, but I remember it being tremendously hot. And it's, you know, it was hard to feel anything significant in such heat. So this is sort of about that. And I suppose it's probably a love poem as well. Thank you all for coming. Romantic. It's hard to mourn in shorts, a straw hat, flip-flops. Cats from the sanctuary sunbathe nude on the headstones or cool the embassies of themselves among the pomegranate trees. Would the cicadas ever quit buckling their ribs? A gecko goes bouldering over Antonio Gramsci's grave, and the beautiful teeth of American tourists are sparkling, but they can't help it, and we are tourists too. We drink water by the Jeroboam and go over again the terrible things Percy Shelley did in the name of his fireproof heart. Die by drowning or don't. These remain our options. The water cycle magics on like something finer than a clock. And John Keats, it's nice to meet you under the circumstances. And John Keats, please excuse us, time has made it late. It's today already, and we have only the rest of our lives. Long may we dabble our feet in the clear Italian lakes. Long may we mosey through the graveyards of the world. Thank you.